Hey everyone, this is Sadia Khan, the host of Immigrantly Podcast, and I have a special favor to ask. Please subscribe to our channel on Apple Podcasts. It's called Immigrantly Uninterrupted. You can subscribe for as low as $34.99 for the entire year or $3.99 a month. Sure, you'll get ad-free episodes, but this isn't really about skipping ads, guys. Independent media is getting squeezed, and anything to do with immigrant identity, you know what I'm talking about. Sponsors are hesitant. Sponsorships have slowed, especially for small mission-driven organizations like ours. So here's what we have decided. Instead of chasing brands or reshaping our voice to fit somebody else's agenda, we are choosing something different. We are choosing you. If Immigrantly has ever made you feel seen, challenged your thinking, or expanded the narrative around identity and belonging, this is how we keep it that way. Independent, unfiltered, and listener-powered. So please consider subscribing to Immigrantly Uninterrupted and help us build this on our terms. You can find the link in our show note. Hey, Immigrantly listeners, Sadia Khan here. Before we get into today's episode, I just have to tell you something really strange that happened to me recently while I was doing research. So I was fact-checking with Claude, asking it history questions about Iran because I was preparing for an interview. And it slipped up in a way that revealed something pretty uncomfortable about whose version of the world gets baked into these systems. I literally caught it being pro-West. I called it out, it agreed, and then, I swear this is true, the AI itself suggested I turn it into a podcast episode. So that episode is coming. I am already looking for guests who can talk about AI ethics, how these large language models are taught and trained. And if you have a guest suggestion for this episode, please DM me at @itsadiak. But today, I want to talk about something else. Yeah, we'll talk about how humanities can be used as psychedelic therapy. But before that, let me preface it by saying, right now we are living in this moment of collective panic about young people, why they are lonely, why they are using ChatGPT to cheat, why aren't they having good sex, why are they falling into manosphere. Every single person, especially on TikTok and Instagram, has a hot take. And almost none of those hot takes are coming from humanities professors. Today's guest thinks this is a massive mistake. Ramzi Furwaz is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he teaches queer and feminist theory, American cultural studies, and LGBTQ literature. He's the author of The New Mutants, Superheroes, and the Radical Imagination of the American Comics and Queer Forms. He also hosts his own podcast, Nerd from the Future, and he has a forthcoming book which really caught my attention, How to Think Like a Multiverse, where he argues that the humanities can work like a form of psychedelic therapy, using art, literature, and media to genuinely transform how students see the world. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Hey, Welcome, Ramsey. How are you doing?
You know, I'm getting through. I, like many of us who have the privilege of living comfortably, on the one hand, I feel that I have this amazing life where I get to work with brilliant students and amazing colleagues, and I travel the world and I'm writing a new book. And then I'm also watching the slow and steady disintegration of our collective inhabitation of this planet. So it's dissonant. It's a very strange, weird place to be. And I'm just trying to be in my lane, trying to uplift people as best as I can.
When you say you want to be in your lane, what does that mean?
I think it means acknowledging what I can do. I have an amazing platform of being given the opportunity to sit in a classroom once a week with a group of brilliant young people who want to learn. I'm teaching a course about the history of AIDS activism, which relates a lot, by the way, to immigration, because there's a long history of people with HIV AIDS being rejected from being able to access immigration in the United States, something that only very recently changed legally. And so the idea that I get to do that and I get to sit with students and I get to talk about ideas and see them grow and evolve, like, I think that that is deeply transformative and amazing. And I think it's very easy in a moment when things are so chaotic to sort of diminish the power of what it is that we do and to say, like, why aren't I out in activist marches? Like, why aren't I doing direct forms of civil disobedience? And it's not that I don't value and believe in those things, that I support those things, but I also know what I do well, which is I educate people, right? So I want to drill down into the thing that I do well, and that is a form of collective uplift.
And that could be a form of activism as well, right?
Oh,
how
completely.
Activism manifests for different people
yeah.
is different. Like,
yeah.
You don't have to be in the marches to express your discomfort with what's happening.
Absolutely.
I was listening to your podcast, looking at the work that you've done. And the interesting thing is, like, this concept of humanities as psychedelic therapy, it blew my mind away. And we will get to that. But let's start with you. How do your parents pronounce your name?
I think that they usually say Ramsey, but it would be pronounced in the Arabic, it would be pronounced Remzi.
Right.
Right. Like right. It's, right. So it's almost like R-E-M-Z-I rather than R-A-M-Z-I. And I think that is quite difficult for people in the United States to say Remzi Fawaz, right? And so people say Ramzi Fawaz, which I love. You know, I love Dr. Fawaz. So yeah, I think like the classical version would be Remzi, but I think that most people just call me Ramzi. And then they say, oh, you're an Egyptian pharaoh. And I say, I'll take it.
Does it bother you when somebody says that?
No, I love that.
Why?
I love the fact that we'll talk about this a lot today. I think of myself as deeply oriented towards the concept of cosmopolitanism, the idea that I have very light attachments to most of my identities. I love the idea of the travel of language, of ideas, of concepts. I am mystified about the world that we live in today, where people have become so xenophobic, so closed off to other cultures, because I'm just excited about losing myself in other ways of being. And so the idea that my name originates as an Egyptian name, but that it was borrowed by the Lebanese and that it's used often in Lebanese culture, and the idea that my family, there has a very complex relationship to that name. My dad and my mom at different points in their lives were teachers. And my dad had a student named Remzi who he did not like at all. And my mother had a student named Remzi who she adored.
And your mother won in the end.
She won because he wasn't able to be there when I was born. And so it's a funny thing that, like, I love the travel of that name. And I love that even though I'm Lebanese, I love that it has a history in Egyptian culture.
So you grew up in Orange County.
I did, right? Yeah.
You were a huge fan. You still are a huge fan of comic books.
Yeah, I don't read them regularly now, but I love them. I mean, I just 20 years of my life dedicated to reading them.
And you were bullied growing up.
Yeah.
So you found solace in comic books. You found solace in characters. What are your favorite characters?
I mean, I always go back to Jean Grey and Storm of the X-Men. Like, part of what I love about the X-Men, I've written extensively about this, is that that comic book is deeply about friendship. It's about the idea of people who are genetic and species outcasts meeting people that share the same social fate, but whom they discover are nothing like them. Like everybody has a different superpower. Everybody has a different skin tone. Everybody comes from a different part of the world, has a different family experience. And I think what's amazing is that the X-Men realize that mutation alone, like the fact that we're different is not enough as the basis for solidarity. We have to develop friendship. We have to find out all of the different ways that we relate because we have shared values or temperaments or personalities or political commitments. And so what's beautiful about the X-Men is that that comic book, while there are certain individual characters like Wolverine and Storm that have become very iconic, really what's most iconic about the comic book are the friendships between certain characters. And Jean Grey, this unbelievably powerful cosmic being named the Phoenix, and Storm, who's like a goddess who controls weather patterns, they had this like lifelong friendship that's been going on for over 70 years in the comic book that is so beautiful and astonishing. And it really, part of what's so powerful to me about it is that in the 70s, especially, at a moment when Black and white women in the feminist movement were very often at odds, and that there had been a schism between them over the question of race and class, that the comic book modeled what it looked like for a white woman and a Black woman to have a deep lifelong friendship that could weather conflict.
Do you think that is the case, though? Do you think there is no hierarchy in how white and Black women interact and the kind of friendships that they form?
Of course there is. I just think that's the nature of being a human. I don't believe that there is such a thing as having a relationship that is completely unmediated by power. And I think like real friendship acknowledges that something is at play. It acknowledges that dimensions of power are at play. And then it asks, how do we negotiate that relationship?
So how do we negotiate that?
I think the first is the building of trust. The idea of listening, of recognizing that when you're in a relationship, that there are uneven relationships of power, like those relationships don't go one way. There are situations in which you could have some, but you could have an interracial friendship in which, let's say, one of those friends is white and that person experiences certain forms of privilege. It's also possible that their friend who is African-American or Latinx or Asian has a job at Harvard. Right? It's also possible that that person has deep connections to their family and the white person is disowned by their family for being gay, right? There are so many different levels at which each person within that duo or that dyad could experience privilege and disadvantage in unevenly distributed ways. And I think that what happens is that in real friendship, people build trust by paying attention to the complexities of another person's life.
But don't you think a person who is at a hierarchical disadvantage would develop resentment?
Sure. And then I think resentment is something you have to deal with and process.
How can you have a solid, trustworthy friendship with resentment lurking around?
I don't see how you could have friendship without resentment.
Really?
Absolutely. I actually have a view of friendship that's very different than many people. I think friendship is built on a form of loving betrayal of another person's self-image. I take this from the writer Tom Roach, brilliant queer theorist, who wrote this beautiful book called The Politics of Friendship, in which he uses Michel Foucault, this very famous French theorist, and his very unusual perception of friendship as forms of mutual betrayal. And what Foucault means is that a true friend is someone who knows you so well that they see different versions of you that you never thought were possible. That person questions you and the limits of your imagination. And they are sometimes beautiful and sometimes those versions of you are ugly. I remember one of the most powerful moments in my friendship with one of my closest friends, Neda Medizade, who teaches at UCLA, is when I was on the job market, the academic job market, and I struggled for 3 years to get a job. And in my third year on the market, I became very jealous of people who were getting jobs. I became very angry and resentful. And my friend said to me, I've never seen this side of you. It's really ugly. Like you are such a loving, tender, kind. She said, I want you to go work on this because it's a dimension of you that doesn't ring true to who you are. And it was painful to hear that, but it was so loving. And that to me, that to me is what friendship is. It's about rubbing up against someone. Some of my closest friends in gay male culture are people who've had incredible access to sex. They are normatively attractive. They're beautiful men. I think I'm a pretty beautiful man, but I don't live in the category that they do. And that has developed a lot of resentment in me where I'm like, why do they have so much access to sex and I don't and whatever? And then I've had to deal with that resentment. I don't want to live in a state of constant anger at my friends. Also, it's not their fault that they're attractive. It's not like they created the system. So I have to learn to distinguish my resentment from my love of those people. And that is what it means to negotiate the unfairness of the world, right? Like, let me put it this way. Are you always the funniest person in your friendship circle? No. But here's the thing. It's like, can you resent to the end of your days the person who's naturally funny? Like, we do live in a world that rewards funniness, that gives those people certain amount of privileges that you're not going to get if you're not fast and if you're not witty.
So here's my question. I think, at least from a very human personal experience, the way I would experience resentment is on the basis of how I see myself relative to the outside world in terms of how I'm performing career-wise, how I present myself. So the measures or parameters that I am more conscious of or I am more fixated on would cause resentment. And to your example, being funny is not something that I think about. It's not something that I care for. But if it were something that I am really fixated on, that's where comparison starts to happen.
Yes, that's fair. And I think that part of what we do psychologically when I use the word negotiate is we decide at every moment in our life, when does it make sense to make the comparison visible in order to show that really pernicious forms of power are operating?
But do you think that visibility is something that we can self-regulate?
I think we have to. How else do you live in the world? I circulate in a world of gay male sexuality and intimacy that is deeply sexually hierarchized. I mean, gay men have the most elaborated, particularized culture around who is attractive, who is fuckable, who is not, based on body, based on the size of genitalia, based on voice, based on all of these different things. Race is a huge factor of that. Like, I often say that, like, gay Middle Eastern men are the people who've treated me the worst in the gay male community because I do not perform classical Middle Eastern masculinity. Like, I refuse to do those things, right? I spent decades so deeply resentful of that hierarchy, not understanding why I have a scintillating personality. I'm fun. I'm smart. I'm successful. I have an amazing family. I'm emotionally regulated. Why shouldn't I get more attraction, more sex, more whatever? And the effect was that I seemed that I was angry all the time. So I had to learn to regulate, not to eliminate my analysis, but to say, maybe my analysis is not always right. Maybe I am getting more attention than I think I am, and I'm resentful that I'm not getting attention from certain people. Maybe I have to kind of figure out what self-love looks like, because I am not alone going to be able to dismantle the structural unfairness of gay male sexual life. What I can do, this goes back to staying in my lane, is I can model what it is like to be a kind, generous, loving, open-hearted gay man so that I draw that energy to myself, right? My resentment for that sexual hierarchy has not gone away. It has loosened its grip on me because I have accepted that the world is unfair and that also sometimes I have benefited from that unfairness because I am actually pretty normatively attractive. Like, and I do make a splash and I do have a profile and people do see me out in the world. And I know people who struggle way more than I do in sex and dating.
And if resentment leads to healing, then that's great, right? That arc is wonderful.
Well, and I will just say, I think resentment rarely leads to healing.
Oh.
I think resentment has to be negotiated and put in its place.
That makes sense.
Right? Like, it leads to healing when you acknowledge that it cannot be the dominant emotion.
Right, right.
What is that classic? I think it's like, I don't know who it is, like Aristotle or Socrates, like a famous Greek philosopher says that resentment is like drinking poison and wishing your enemy dead.
You're absolutely right. Resentment, if regulated, leads to healing.
Leads to healing.
Yes.
Correct.
I stand corrected.
Right? Like, what we know about emotions, and this leads to a little bit later, we can talk about my psychedelics work, is that They are an affective or sensory capacity of being a human that have developed over millions of years of evolution, which means that they tell us something really important, right? Like feminists in the 70s said, our feelings are not irrational. They are knowledge. They tell us about how we're responding to the world. That doesn't mean they're right or wrong. They can also misread the world, right? Resentment is a really important feeling state. It also,
like anger is.
Absolutely. But it sometimes doesn't read or interpret the world accurately. Like sometimes it comes out of a place of like paranoia or ego or whatever, being able to distinguish when it's helpful and when it's not, and neither banishing it nor magnifying it, but letting it be one of many feelings that we have.
Ramzi, talking about uplifting other people, helping other people, healing other people in some ways, we're in this moment where everybody is talking about young people, right? They are lonely. They are addicted to their phones. Although I will contend older folks are as addicted to their phones as young folks.
Sure.
Young people are not having sex. They are drifting towards manosphere. They are cheating with ChatGPT. I mean, there's so many different stories and through lines of this. What do you think is everyone getting wrong about what's happening with young folks right now?
That's such a good question. There's a couple of few answers to that. First, I think that people don't realize that young people have a very sophisticated critique of their own addictions. Like the young people of this generation are more educated than any other group in the world. They do struggle with more cognitive issues around learning and comprehension, et cetera. And that is a result of a variety of historical factors, including lowering of funding in schools, the increasing stress on grades and upward mobility and all of that stuff. And this changing nature of our chaotic world, which produces a lot of anxiety, right? And a lot of stress and a lot of, mental struggle, psychological struggle. But I think they are, because they are so educated and they know so much about the complexities of the world, they are deeply aware of the fact that they are driven to distract themselves through social media, that they're driven towards a culture of optimization. And I watch them every day negotiating. That's apparently my favorite word today. Their way around it. They are not simply laying down and accepting things as they are. I see my students struggling with social media addiction. They're like, I'm trying to get off of it this week. I'm talking to my therapist about it. I'm trying, right? So what they need from the analysis of them is they need role models, and we're not doing a good job.
Why is that?
I think that my larger view is that I think we're a deeply psychologically dysfunctional and abusive society. And I think that there are many reasons for that. But my own interpretation, which I've said on other podcasts, is like American society has been the most abundant culture in the history of the human species. In the last 150 years, we have experienced greater upward mobility, access to goods, access to food, access to wealth than any other group of people in the history of this planet. Human beings are not psychologically adapted yet to having that level of abundance.
Oh, interesting.
We have historically lived in unbelievable amounts of scarcity. So we are literally oriented towards hoarding and protecting what's ours. And I think Americans, if you study American history, there is a moment after World War II where Americans honestly believed that they would be the saviors of the planet.
Well, they still believe that, don't they?
I mean, yes, but they thought they were going to spread the idea of the middle class way of life to the planet, right? Like there was this belief in upward mobility and the idea of universal access to education. The United States, for all of its fuck it upness,
I like that word,
was one of the biggest backers of the United Nations. I think it's important to remember that the United States, for all of its duplicity, for all of its corruption, did believe at some point there were members of our country, of people in great power who believe that a global order based on universal human rights, the idea that everybody had to belong somewhere, that everybody had a right to a home, that everybody had a right to education and medicine. These were ideas that were promulgated out of the abundance of the post-World War II period in the United States. What happened was that after 20 years of this explosive abundance in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, Americans began to realize that the way they were doing it was unsustainable. The end of the 70s sees one of the worst recessions in the history of the United States, right? And suddenly after 25, 30 years, Americans are like, maybe this won't last forever. I think that we experienced a collective psychological breakdown about having so much abundance and then discovering that it might go away.
So is this panic for self-preservation? Is that what's going on?
Yes, I think it's that. And I think it's become self-destructive. I think the irony is that the obsession with hoarding, with retaining, with not losing, America first, this is for us. It has made everybody not only psychologically miserable, but suicidal. I think we are damaging ourselves in the interest of self-preservation. And what's sad is that there is enough to go around. There are ways to be completely sustainable about the circulation of goods and the circulation of food and the circulation of resources. And here's the biggest thing I want to say, but just to wrap that up, the biggest horror that Americans keep running into is that all that abundance didn't make anybody happy. That's the core root of the self-destructiveness of our culture. Of course, wealth and fame and money makes life comfortable. And there are joys that come with that. There's a lot of rich people that are perfectly happy with their comforts. But generally speaking, at a deep existential level, the fact that Americans have this much abundance and yet are unbelievably polarized, have incredible wealth inequality, that millions of children experience child sexual abuse, that people are deeply suicidal and depressed and drug addicted or whatever, tells us that the abundance alone did not respond to much deeper human needs.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes. Ramsey, going back to the classroom and students, young folks, how do you engage with them on these conversations and what kind of response do you get? Walk me through a session.
So step one is just for audiences to know, I teach extensively about the history of radical social movement activism in the United States. That's one of many things I teach about. So I teach classes about the queer and feminist 70s and the women's movement. I teach about civil rights and the Black Power movement. I'm teaching a class right now about the history of AIDS activism. The reason I do that, just so audiences know, is not because I'm interested in indoctrinating students in left-wing ideas. I want students to know about the history of human beings who decided that something about their existence needed to change for their survival, and deciding to find like-minded people and to find nonviolent ways to make that change.
You said nonviolent. All the movements that you've talked about, some of them were not nonviolent, though.
I would say that they were, like, if you think about Black Power, Black Power didn't actively go to shoot people.
But do you think having this idea of movements that are supposed to be messy, that are supposed to be unpredictable, to be nonviolent through and through, that's like euphemism for control.
I would put it this way. I think it's perfectly possible to say that we lead with the value of nonviolence, and we will also protect ourselves when people want to try and kill us. I think both things are true. The civil rights movement partly could only succeed because when civil rights activists were being physically attacked, there were other people who were willing to step in who were not one of the activists to say, I get off of these people, right? When the freedom riders rode through the South, they were physically assaulted multiple times. And part of the reason that some of them survived is that there were other Black people who were not activists who carried guns. Now, it is possible, again, to say when we do social movement activism, we commit ourselves to nonviolence, which does not mean that we're going to allow ourselves to be killed, which does not mean that there is never a place for violence, but that social movement activism cannot be the place for that. right? What does Frantz Fanon say, the great decolonial thinker? And he says, look, there is no such thing as decolonization without violence. The people who subjected you to colonization did it through mass murder. And we are going to have to fight back violently. And my students were shocked by this when we studied it last year, because they were like, they were so obsessed with this idea that any form of violence is always bad. They had never thought about the idea of like, yeah, but when you're being mass murdered, you have to defend yourself. But Fanon was very clear-eyed. He said, once you start using violence, you are now tainted with exactly the kind of horror of the people who colonized you. And it's going to require a huge amount of labor to prevent the next regime that takes power from being as violent.
Isn't there a difference between defensive and offensive violence? So why are we putting them together? Why are we lumping them?
I guess that's fair. I think you could say that self-defense is not violence. So then the question becomes, when you use the tools of violence, if you think about the Battle of Algiers, a very famous decolonial film that tells the story of the project to decolonize Algeria, and the fact that a lot of the activities of those activists were not only in self-defense. They bomb different city buildings. They kill innocent civilians. They're basically saying, get the fuck out. There is a place for debating the validity of that position, right? But that is still violence, and violence has consequences. And Fanon is like, you have to be honest about both.
I'm curious to know, how do you distinguish between violence and resistance then?
Do you have to distinguish them fully? I mean, don't they sometimes function as the same thing?
I mean, depending on what tools and what mechanisms you're using to resist, right?
Yeah, I think you would have to take it case by case and say, this is an instance in which violence is resistance. Like using the means of force to transform something, a debate that happens among people who do any form of activism, right wing, left wing, whatever, is if violence gets you easy results, threatening to kill people and or killing them and or dismembering them usually makes people do what you want them to do pretty quickly. And the problem is that the easiness of some of those effects make people suddenly start to think, you know what, violence is so much easier than collective action. Because collective action takes so much time. It's literally all about the democracy is about the endless meeting. Like all it is sitting in rooms, having meetings with annoying people who you have to live with. And part of democracy at its best is developing the tolerance.
That's true.
To manage competing, irritating, frustrating perspectives until you can make a decision about something. And violence often becomes a replacement for collective decision-making because it's so much easier to tell people to fuck off and to just throw a bomb on them, right? I'm so moved by what Zohran Mamdani said the other day. He said, I find an anti-Islamic march through New York really disgusting. And also, I will fight for its right to happen. As long as it isn't violent, because he's like, people need to know the perspectives of their fellow citizens. And one perspective that's very painful and gross is that some people believe that all Islamic people are violent and awful. And you have to face the reality of that perspective if you're going to address it.
I feel like today's generation, as you said, they are more morally aware. They are more plugged into what's happening, not just in the US, but around the world. But they've also been given vernacular. And sometimes I feel like they don't fully comprehend what that vernacular means or what it entails. And they use it because it's cool and it makes them morally upright. How do you parse it out?
I am so glad you mentioned this, because this gives me an opportunity to just briefly address the problem of wokeness.
Okay.
It's important for people to realize that the vernacular that a younger generation has gained, the vernacular of social justice, of race, class, gender, sexuality, of intersectionality, while many of those ideas circulate among academics, We didn't teach them as moralizing bludgeons. We did not teach them in order to get students to yell at each other about using the wrong pronouns or not talking about race the right way. That's not our intention, and that's not what we were teaching for the last 30 years. We were asking students to recognize that the world is multidimensional, complex, requires a vaster range of vocabulary to describe the uneven distribution of privileges and disadvantages and all of that. It was about nuance. But the reality is that young people are young. And this generation has emerged in an era of social media where very complex ideas about identity, about power, about money, about the distribution of privileges, about all of those questions have been reduced to sound bites on social media. When students deploy what we think of as woke language, it's not a sign that they were indoctrinated by people at universities. It's a sign that this is their simplified version of complicated ideas. And you could give them the benefit of the doubt that it's a bunch of young people who really want to do good in the world and who want life to be better for people.
But do you think it does disservice to the idea of wokeness and the concept because it is undermining the concept itself?
Absolutely. Which is why we don't need to be that attached to the concept. The one part of wokeness I love is I love the idea of being awake. I love the image as somebody who's I consider myself a Buddhist spiritually. I consider myself as someone who studies psychedelics and who has done lifelong therapy and who does a lot of healing work on myself. And I try to transmit that to my students in the best that I can. Like, I love being alert to the world. I love being awake. So the concept of awokenness has nothing to do with left or right. It has to do with being engaged in a lively, vibrant way with the world. What I don't like is when the idea of wokeness gets attached to a logic of moralizing at people in order to punish people for perceived slights and failures to acknowledge complex social realities.
I love that.
There is no reason to moralize. Why don't you figure out what you believe about race, about gender, about whatever, and then be open to taking in different perspectives and change your mind? Like, I'm going to give an example. My students love to talk about the best way to talk about race without actually knowing what they believe about race.
How so?
Like, they've never sat and thought about it, right? They've never thought about what they really think about identity. They've allowed other people to tell them what to think.
Yeah, I can see that.
Right? And so I share with them my own position, which is very controversial and very unorthodox.
Okay, what's that?
I generally think that identity is socially constructed. Everything from like race, gender, sexuality, I think they have material reality written on the skin, on the body, etc. But we attach meanings to those realities. So at the end of the day, I don't actually believe that anybody owns an identity outright. I don't believe that just because I'm gay, I own gayness and you don't get to have anything to do with gayness.
But don't you think identities are lived and not owned? So people who speak out and speak up against folks who don't see different identities, they are coming from a place of these are our lived experiences and these are the identities that we are living and we should be able to live them unapologetically versus I own them.
I think that's beautifully said. I think most people talk about it in terms of ownership. That's my own view.
Yeah, there is some gatekeeping around it, you're right.
Right? Like if you think about it, like to me, appropriation, for instance, is really in its purest form. It's when somebody is borrowing from another culture that is unfamiliar to them or that they didn't grow up in or didn't live in and then profiting off of it in a massive way without giving back to that community. But now people think appropriation is like any time that you engage with or show affinity to anything from a hairstyle to people can wear whatever fucking hair they want. You don't have to like it. You can say this is stupid or whatever, or I think you look dumb with dreadlocks or whatever, but it's a free country. Like people are allowed to do what they want at some level.
I think it goes back to, again, ownership, and it goes back to co-opting and power dynamic. If you don't have that power dynamic when you are affiliating yourself with another identity, it's absolutely fine. But if you're co-opting it through power, then it becomes problematic.
Okay, so let's add another layer to that. In a world that is driven by so many power dynamics, it's almost impossible at this point to show affinity or appreciation or connection to a culture that was not your initial lived one without there being some sort of power being exercised. And with that knowledge, I believe we have to accept that power is still going to operate, and that in order to step outside of our immediate identities and to meet other people halfway, we will have to get better at allowing people to step into our worlds and then saying, oh, you know, I can see, just so you know, like, this is actually a little bit more offensive to me and this isn't. Like, let me give an example. Like, I know gay people who, when they see any straight person performing any kind of queerness, they're so offended because they're like, that's not your life or whatever. I could care less. Say whatever you want. Drag is a global phenomenon. I don't think gay people own it. The fact that gay people among themselves cannot agree about the degree to which they are willing to give up their ownership or claim to possession of their identity suggests that there is no universal rule book on the appropriate way to be Black or to be gay or to be trans or to be whatever.
So how about we let people who want ownership versus people who are generous in letting other people come into their spheres both coexist, right? Because, I mean, on the flip side, then we shouldn't be judging people who are showing ownership of or are gatekeeping.
The idea is, like, if we go back to Native and Indigenous philosophies, like, Indigenous people didn't believe they possessed the land, right? So as some Indigenous scholars would say, they were never dispossessed exactly because they never thought they owned it. What happened was that a logic of possession came in, and that is what dispossessed people, right? Is that people were forced into a logic of ownership where now Native and Indigenous people have to demand the right to the land when in fact their original viewpoint was we all own the land together. There's enough to go around. We can share.
Yeah, but that would require a collective understanding and self-awareness of what it means, right?
Correct. How could we possibly move toward that if we couldn't be more generous about our identities?
That's a fair point.
You will have to risk having something sort of stolen from you or taken away. And listen, one can recognize that some of us are more privileged to let go of some of our identities than others, right? Like, I already have a job. I'm comfortable, whatever. All of those things could go away. We live in a very precarious world. But, like, I don't feel the need to have that much ownership over my identity because I also am surrounded by lots of friends of different identities. And, like, I don't care. But if my livelihood depended on my being able to say, but I'm gay, then I could see why I would be more attached to it.
Or if somebody was denying your gayness just because you're gay.
Sure.
What you're internalizing, how you're feeling personally, is a function of how society makes you feel, right? Like, for me, I am a practicing Muslim, and the way America makes me feel around my Muslimness or my religion, it really forces me in some ways to latch onto it strongly because I'm like, you know what? I believe in it because you're cornering me into saying, well, this ideology is problematic.
Okay, so I want to flip that around. That is a completely legitimate reaction formation. There would be another reaction that would say, you're the one who's so fixated on it. You're oppressing me because you're so fixated on my religion and my understanding of my religion is complex, multidimensional, and open. Like, another response to having one's identity diminished rather than hold on to it tighter is to hold on to it looser, is to say, I'm actually not that attached to one rigid notion of identity. You are. You're the one who's pigeonholing me, right? Like, so a good example for me is, like, I taught a class on Arab American literature and popular culture 3 semesters ago when the encampments had happened. I felt like I was shocked that even though there's a very strong Middle Eastern studies department here, nobody was doing Arab American stuff. And I'm an American studies scholar. It's not even my area of expertise, but I was trained by a brilliant scholar of Arab American culture, Melanie McAllister. And I thought, I'm going to use everything I learned and I'm going to teach this class. Loved teaching this class. It was so much fun. The students were so amazing. And we talked a lot about Islamophobia and anti-Arab sentiment. The students, many of whom are white passing, like half the class was white identified, half were from different parts of the Middle East. And many of the students who were Arab American but white passing talked about experiencing Islamophobia and anti-Arab sentiment where they grew up. And I thought, I never experienced any anti-Arab sentiment when I was a kid in Orange County, ever. Neither did my mother. We talked about it, and I think it's because I was so visibly gay. Americans are so racist about Arab people. They assume that Arab people are so homophobic that they cannot imagine that there would be a visibly gay Middle Eastern person. Like, they have a really difficult time thinking of those categories together. So in a way, when people saw me being so flamboyantly gay, they assumed I was white or Jewish. Not that there's anything wrong with either of those categories, right? But like, they couldn't fathom that I was Lebanese American and gay. They couldn't also fathom that I'm a Lebanese American person who feels a very light attachment to my Middle Easternness, to my Americanness, to my gayness. These are all socially imputed categories that I didn't get to choose.
You see them as social constructs. You see them as fluid or ever-changing. Yeah, I get that.
To say that doesn't mean that they aren't real, that they aren't material, that they are not lived. I feel they under-describe me.
Give me a word that you think, and there may not be just one word, that really truly encapsulates who you are as a person.
Intense. I think that my most identifying characteristic is temperamental. I'm a radiant person. When I was growing up, people were so critical. Like, my teachers loved me and my parents loved me, but most people in the world were like, you're too loud, you're too intense, you're too passionate, you're too whatever. It was always associated with gayness. Like, you're so gay, right? And then as I grew older and I grew into my masculinity and my version of intellect and whatever, I realized I'm deeply interested in the world. I'm like, why are things this way? Like, why do people talk like this? Why do people do this? Right? And my intensity, I came to realize, is a great gift given to me by the universe, by God, I don't know, that people are actually desperate to be close to. People really want a piece of the intensity. They're like, oh my God, you're so energetic and you're so fun. I've had to actually learn to modulate that because people can use it like a jumper cable. Like, they're like, I want to steal all of your energy because I don't feel great about my life or whatever. So I often say to people, if I had to hierarchize my identities, which you don't have to, by the way, but if I had to.
You could, yeah.
I would say that number one, I'm an intellectual. Like, at my core, that's my great identity. It's not racial, it's not ethnic, it's not national, it's not gender. I'm an intellectual. I want to know why things work. I'm curious, I ask things.
I like that.
The second identity is temperamental. I'm intense. I'm an intense person. Then it's like, I'm gay. Then it's like, I'm Middle Eastern. And it's not to knock any of those. It's just to say, like, I don't feel that attached to the most ordinate or visible or magnified forms of identity that we're obsessed with in this culture.
I love that. And you know what? It's such an interesting, eye-opening conversation because I've never thought of myself in that light, right? I have always focused or highlighted my, as you said, physical identity, my accent, language, norms, culture that I come from. But having this conversation with you makes me think, what are some identifying markers in my life that I've missed because I'm so fixated on these? I do want to talk about one thing, which is humanities as psychedelic therapy. Humanities have existed for eons, right? People study art, literature. But do you think just having that interaction with art and literature would produce those visual, auditory hallucinations or seeing yourself in a different light? Like, What confuses me in this argument is, if that is the case, why haven't we witnessed it already?
Great question. So the comparison I make between humanities education and psychedelic therapy looks something like this. Psychedelic therapy relies on a structure. It's not just taking drugs, right? It's about creating a situation in which you are put in a safe space, working with one or two psychological practitioners, a therapist, a guide. Sometimes you do it by yourself. Often you do it in group. You take a psychedelic medicine within a framework. So when you take it, you sit and talk to the therapist before you take it. What are your intentions? Why do you want to do it, right? You shape the environment. You take the drug or the medicine, whether it's psilocybin or LSD or DMT or whatever. You then have an extraordinary psychic and embodied transport, or what we call a trip, right? Your body is experiences a massive overflow of emotion and feelings. It is defined, as the historian Ido Hartigson says, you know, by amplification. It's an amplification of your already existing capacities to feel and to sense and to see, etc. That can look like a million different things, by the way. Some people hallucinate, some people just go inward, some people, there's so many different things. But the key mechanism of healing, like when we talk about the fact that people are using psychedelics to try to respond to long-term forms of mental distress, the mechanism of healing is repeatedly being revealed to be the process of integrating or talking about the experience afterward. If it were the drugs alone, then I always say this, then millions of ravers around the world would be healed of their trauma. And we know that that's not true. So the process of then working through what happened to you, producing meaning making, saying, I saw these things, I felt these things, this is what I think they were telling me. That is called integration, the process of taking this experience and integrating it into the holistic fabric of your being. And it usually works really well with groups. So I've done group psychedelic therapy 3 times. It's been life transformative. And what I noticed in each of those integration sessions as it was happening was, this looks just like my classroom. I was like, this is what we do. I don't give students drugs. Obviously, it's illegal. And as I always joke, I wouldn't want to do drugs with them. They're like the last people that I want to do that with, with like 21-year-olds. But what I give them instead of psychoactive medicines is art, literature, media, culture that affects their psychology. I expose them to a variety of art forms that shake the foundations of what they know to be possible. Imagine like when they're watching a movie, their optic nerve is absorbing things they've never seen before. It's going into their brain. Like I didn't have to give them drugs to ingest. I just had to ask them to read something. Right? It's literally activating neural pathways in the brain that didn't exist before. But I don't just leave them. We then meet every week and we integrate what happened to them through long form discussion. So to answer your question more specifically, do I believe that just encounters with art change people? No, they're just catalytic moments. It's the exchange of interpretations that allows people's perspective to change. So this is why the power of education, why so many people also want to eliminate higher education, is they're terrified of the fact that we produce this one space where we sit and integrate worldly experience in the interest of change, of people evolving and transforming. Why hasn't this happened more widely? Think about how few spaces in public we have to talk to each other anymore without just yelling at each other on social media. We just don't share our interpretations in a way that is dialogic. People just share hot takes on the internet and yell at each other, and that's it, right? The lack of a space, the lack of tolerance that Americans have for just negotiating differences, of seeing someone interpret a movie differently and not running away, right? Of just the friction of that. So that to me is the beauty of both the psychedelic experience and humanities education. It's about not running away from friction.
How would you apply it if you were to apply it outside the classroom? What kind of conditions, framework, mechanisms would you use?
It's a great question. So I'll talk about my own life. I mean, the number one bedrock is that I believe in exposure. I expose myself to such a vast range of media. You know, I go to art museums, I play video games, I go to raves and I dance. I read tons of books. You know, I never can achieve as much as I want. There's so much that I don't view. I don't watch TikTok just because of time constraints. You know, I'm already wasting enough time on social media. But the first thing is that I am open. I'm really open to being disturbed by ideas that are scary and weird. I'm really open to people disagreeing with me. I'm not scared of confrontation. So like I often say, I'm a very strong opinions held lightly kind of person. So that's one.
I like that description.
Number two, I prioritize talking to people in my life. I understand that people have different temperamental tolerances. So some people are really one of my best friends in the world is very introverted and only wants to talk on the phone maybe once a month for 20 minutes. But we text constantly and he loves leaving a voice memo or texting or whatever. Other friends, the amount of time I spend on the phone is unbelievable. It is just as much as going to the gym and eating right and moving around. I need to be talking to people that I love and I need to be telling them what I'm watching and reading. So I get into the practice of not only experiencing things in the world, but wanting to know what other people think. Like just screw empathy. I love empathy. Empathy's great. How about just like curiosity about what people think? How about just like being like, oh, I'm not the only person that exists on the planet. Like, I wonder what other people think and why. How about practicing engagement? Like building a tolerance for interaction. So that's two. And I would say the last component, I think this is like one of the biggest problems in American culture today. People love to talk a big game about their politics, about their intellect, about their values, and then they don't implement it in how they behave at all. And the third most important element of how I live out the things I teach to my students is I'm actively working to implement what I'm learning in my engagements with art and other people in my everyday life. I know I need to keep working at getting more gentle, at having less heated conflict, at questioning the intensity with which I approach everything. These are things I'm working on. I go to yoga, I go to therapy, and I don't just sit and talk about my problems. I think about actionable ways to behave differently so that I actually live better and in greater harmony with myself and other people. And that lack of ability to connect insight with action is one of the fundamental problems in our society. We talk all about how terrible the dating pool is, but we don't stop ghosting people. And we don't stop behaving better. And we don't stop running after people that are unavailable. It's like, girl, if you don't want all that shit, then stop running after people that are like, I had to learn that lesson. It goes back to the resentment thing.
It's like being self-aware, but in a way where, again, self-awareness doesn't just become another word or vernacular that we are throwing out there. Being very intentional about that self-awareness. I love that.
Now, are all the traitors present? Let's get started, shall we?
From rags to riches.
I'm so sick of this.
Working like a dog and being treated worse.
Yorkshire to New York.
We're climbers, you and me.
A life dedicated to revenge.
Let's make this an occasion to remember.
A Woman of Substance on Channel 4 starts tonight at 9.
How do you define the United States of America?
Everything, everywhere, all at once. That is the only reason I decided to study this country. I dedicated my life to studying American culture because despite the fact that it is so deeply compromised, so contradictory, so corrupt in many ways, right? Before there was the genocide of Native Americans, before there were all these awful things, there was this one idea that was like, we don't want to live under the boot heel of the church or of this society or of the aristocracy. Like, people should be able to choose for themselves how they want to live. And so all of the early writings of the early Americans are all about the diversity of religious sects. You know, Alexis de Tocqueville, the French philosopher, when he came in the 1820s and 30s to the United States, he was like, these people invent everything from nothing. They create new associations. They create all of this stuff. They're so inventive. They're not held back by tradition. And I was talking to my mom today. What is so sad about where we've arrived is that we have forgotten the beauty of the originality of people going their own way, but together. And so instead, we ask people to assimilate, like to what? To be homogenized, to be exactly like us. We have shorn ourselves of imagination, creativity, surprise, the idea that maybe other people's way of living might be a little better than yours, or maybe you could borrow 10% of what they're doing. There is, so I love that what the project of the United States did is it encouraged the bringing together of so many different perspectives on what the good life could be. And so that to me is everything everywhere all at once. And like, that's why I love studying it.
Ramsey, when is your book coming out?
Oh gosh, it's still a while. I'm very glad to have a book contract with my press, NYU Press. The book hopefully will be finished in 2027, and usually academic books take another year. But people can read three articles from the book, which are all on my website. I wrote an essay called Tripping on Mushrooms with Edward Said, The Case for Literary Studies as Holistic Medicine. I wrote another essay called Web Detachments that's about the Spider-Verse films, which I love so much. So all of those are on my website. I also have my podcast, Nerd from the Future, which people can listen to. A lot of the ideas from the book are in the podcast. We have a second season coming out in April. And then lastly, I am teaching a course, a 5-day workshop at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California at the beginning of June. And people can find that on my website, ramseyfawaz.com. It's all about what we've been talking about. It's called The Thrill of Groundlessness, Flowing Through Life Without Absolutes. And it's all about what it means to live in a world where our identities are not absolute and fixed.
I love it. Ramsey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As I said, we could have gone on for another hour. Hopefully we can have you back on Immigrantly.
I would be delighted. Thank you. This was so beautiful. Oh my God, I could have talked to you for hours. You asked the best questions.
Thank you, Ramsey. What a fun conversation. And very introspective. You know what I took away from this, among many other things? I have for a long time been fixated on physical attributes that represent me or present me in a certain way to the rest of the world. My accent, my Muslimness, my South Asian identity. And what Ramsey reminded me today is that there's so much more to me as a human than those physical attributes, how I interact with the world. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you did, please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to Immigrantly. Come back next week for another incredible conversation. This episode is written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shane Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another important and intellectually teasing conversation. Take care and be kind to others.